This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Next week marks an important anniversary in the civil rights movement. 50 years ago, on May 4, 1961, the first bus carrying an integrated group of self-proclaimed freedom riders left Washington, D.C. and headed towards the South. On today's Fresh Air, as we think about events in the South which took place 50 years ago in a different era, we also want to send our sympathies and best wishes to the thousands of people who have suffered losses from the destruction of tornadoes which tore through the South earlier this week. During the spring and summer of 1961, the Freedom Riders challenged segregation by riding together on buses through the Deep South. They demanded unrestricted access to segregated buses, as well as bus terminal restaurants and waiting rooms. The Freedom Riders were pledged to nonviolence and kept that pledge even when attacked and bloodied by their racist opponents. Our guest, Raymond Arsenault, is the author of a book called The Freedom Riders. Before we meet him, we're going to hear an excerpt of an interview Terry recorded with the late James Farmer, a co-founder of the Riders, and of CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. In this 1985 interview, he described a turning point for the Freedom Riders when the group he was traveling with was arrested in Mississippi.
There were three charges: disobeying an officer, disturbing the peace, and inciting to riot. We were arrested by Captain Ray, who was the chief of police of the city of Jackson, when he ordered me to move on. And I asked where. The young lady with me who had locked arms with me, she and I were about to go into the restaurant there in the waiting room, the white waiting room, for dinner. And other Freedom Riders followed the two of us and were similarly told to get into the paddy wagon. And we were taken to jail. Then I sent orders by my lawyer to my CORE staff in New York to begin immediately recruiting Freedom Riders, white and black, from all over the country, sending them into Jackson to try, in true Gandhian fashion, to fill up the jails. We were not going to bail out. We were going to stay in as long as we could stay in and still file an appeal, and that turned out to be 40 days and 40 nights.
Did the jails want you out?
Yes. They quickly found out that we were not going to bail out right away. And then what they wanted to do was to make it so uncomfortable for us that we'd wish we had never come and we'd stop others from coming. They did not physically beat us, though they tried once at one place. And that backfired because I got one young man bailed out, and he called the FBI, and he also held a press conference. So that stopped the physical brutality. But they did such things as putting so much salt in the food that we couldn't eat it. Many of us were chain smokers, and we were denied any cigarettes, but the guards would walk by our cells puffing on cigarettes and blowing the smoke into our cells at great length. We were students or readers. They denied us any newspapers or any books, refused to let any come in, refused to let us have any paper or any pencils to do any writing whatsoever. We were denied any visitors except our lawyer. This was psychological brutality.
You were also banned from singing at one point.
Well, they tried to stop us from singing. We sang all the freedom songs we knew, and we made up new ones. I made up one song, wrote one song. Actually, it was, I put new words to an old labor song, "Which Side Are You On?"
What were the words you wrote?
Well, I can't sing, so I won't even try to sing it. It said, "Come all you freedom fighters, good news to you I'll tell, of how the good old Freedom Ride has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? 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 They say in Hinds County, where Jackson was, Jackson, Mississippi, no neutrals have they met. You're either for the Freedom Ride or you're Tom for Ross Barnett." He was the governor of Mississippi. "My father was a freedom fighter, and I'm a freedom fighter's son. and I'll stick to the Freedom Ride till every battle's won. Well, the jailers went wild at our singing because we were singing as loudly as we could and our voices were wafting out over the city of Jackson. And the windows were open. They would come in and slam our windows shut and we would open them again and sing more and more and more. Other Freedom Riders, the black women in another wing, the white men in another wing, the white women in another wing would pick up the song, and so the jailhouse was rocking with freedom song. The jailers are running around saying, "Stop that singing! Stop that singing! Stop it!" And we continued singing because it was good for our morale. It was good for our morale, and if there were any fear left in us, that fear was dissipated by the song.
What did they do to try to prevent you from singing after closing the window and yelling at you didn't work?
Well, in Parchman, the state penitentiary, said, "If you don't stop that singing, we'll take away your mattresses." Well, now that sounds like a juvenile threat, but it was an important threat because the little thin straw mattress was the only comfort we had. Everything else was cold, hard stone and steel in those tiny little cells. But there was this little mattress, which was comfort, which was a symbol of home, symbol of domesticity. And now they're going to take that away. We'd have nothing else. Well, that caused some people to stop singing for a while until one young man who was a Bible student reminded everybody what they were doing. Said, "Here they're trying to take your soul away, you see. It's not the mattress, it's your soul." And then one Freedom Rider yelled, "Guards! Guards! Guards!" And the deputy came running out into the cell block to see what was wrong. And this Freedom Rider shouted, "Come get my mattress. I'll keep my soul." And then song exploded again. We began singing. Then another time, I have to laugh when I think of this. One Freedom Rider was complaining that this deputy, who was in charge of the guards, always called us boy, you boys. He said, "Why does he always call us boy? We are men. I think we ought to refuse to answer until he calls us men." Another one reminded him that that was just a custom down south, and he didn't mean anything derogatory by it. So this fellow said, first fellow said, "I think I'll ask him." He called Deputy Tyson. Said, "Deputy Tyson, what?" Says, "Do you mean anything derogatory when you call us boy?" Deputy Tyson said, "I don't know nothing about no rogatory. All I know is if you boys don't stop that singing, you're going to be singing in the rain." And then somebody started singing again. They pulled in a high-pressure fire hose and washed us all down with it. We tumbled over and everything was floating in the water in our cells. One of the Freedom Riders then yelled, "Deputy Tyson, next time you're going to do that, bring us some soap so we can take a shower."
The late James Farmer speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 1985. He died in 1999. You can hear the complete interview at our website, freshair.npr.org. Raymond Arsenault is the author of the book Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Arsenault is the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida in St. Petersburg. Terry spoke with him in 2006.
Raymond Arsenault, welcome to Fresh Air. We heard James Farmer describing that the Freedom Riders didn't want to be bailed out of the Parchman prison. What was the philosophy behind that jail, no bail approach they took?
This was one of the most controversial innovations of the Congress of Racial Equality. There had been talk about jail no bail for years in the late 1950s, but no one had either marshaled enough courage or audacity to try it on any kind of mass level. And the first jail no bail actually took place in Tallahassee, Florida. A young activist named Patricia Stevens and several other activists decided to take Gandhian philosophy literally and to fill the jails as best they could. And then there was another jail no bail incident in Rock Hill, South Carolina in early 1961. And this gave the Corps, or Congress of Racial Equality, leaders hope that this could become kind of standard operating procedure in the movement. But the Freedom Rides was really the first time that this was tried on any kind of mass level.
Why was it controversial within the civil rights movement?
It seemed to go against common sense. It seemed counterintuitive, I think, to a lot of people. Thurgood Marshall made a famous statement in Nashville when he was lecturing at Fisk, and he was criticizing the jail no bail, and he said, "For God's sake, if somebody can get you out, get out. Take the offer. Anybody who knows what it's like to be in a southern jail, to be a black person or even a white person who's a dissenter in jail, knows it's a very dangerous place to be." So Marshall was taking perhaps the more pragmatic view, but jail no bail became a badge of honor and a elemental strategy for CORE during the early 1960s.
Was it a troublesome mood for the prison authorities because they had to deal with all of these civil rights activists who were being very disruptive to the prison system?
I think it was very confounding for them. They were accustomed to intimidating people. They had all kinds of ways of manipulating and threatening and in many cases, actually physically harming people. And you know, southern jails, and particularly southern prisons, Parchman being the most notorious, but even the county jails and the city jails, they weren't accustomed to people trying to stay inside the bars. And so it defied logic for them, and they didn't know quite how to deal with it.
So when the Freedom Riders refused to post bail, how did they get out of prison?
Well, in the case of most of the Freedom Riders who ended up behind bars in Mississippi, more than 300 ended up in Parchman Prison, there was a quirk of Mississippi law which said you had to get out before 40 days to be able to file an appeal. And of course, ultimately, what the Congress of Racial Equality and the Freedom Riders and the other organizations involved wanted to do was to create a test case to force the legal justice system, if possible, at the local and state level, but at least at the federal level, to endorse and to sustain and protect their constitutional rights. So they needed these appeals. So they would stay in for 39 days, but they would get out on time so that they could file their appeals in the Mississippi case. And almost all the southern states had some quirks like this. Part of the game in the Freedom Rides between the white segregationists and the Freedom Riders was a test of resources. They kept increasing the bond that they had to post. They tried to break the civil rights movement financially. They knew that resources were limited and that most of those resources were with the NAACP, which had an ambivalent attitude towards the Freedom Rides, that there was a feeling that the Freedom Rides was an enormous gamble, that if all this money was poured into it and there were no positive results, then this movement would be set back, that it would not advance. So there were a lot of people within the movement who had very serious questions about the wisdom of playing this very dangerous game.
Raymond Arsenault speaking with Terry Gross. He's the author of the book Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Next week marks the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the Freedom Rides. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Raymond Arsenault, author of the book Freedom Riders, 1961, and the Struggle for Racial Justice.
The Freedom Riders were challenging segregation on interstate bus rides. Now, the buses had long been the center of protests in the South. Why were buses at the center of civil rights actions throughout the 20th century?
Well, there was an ongoing debate among civil rights activists as to where to place stress on the move for desegregation. Where should they begin? Should they begin with the schools? Should they begin with unemployment or employment policies? Should they begin with transportation? And there was no consensus on this matter. They were fighting on all fronts, but the buses and the trains and streetcars were a daily irritant for blacks. So it was a natural place where people would file lawsuits, where they would try to test the limits of, of Jim Crow culture. And this was particularly true in the 1940s when people began to have sort of individual freedom rides. They didn't use that term, but there were a number of people who challenged the Jim Crow conventions. Jackie Robinson, 1944, refused to move to the back of the bus near Fort Hood in Texas, and he was court-martialed. He was eventually exonerated, but that was just one example.
Now, the Freedom Riders were specifically testing new law. What law were they testing?
They were testing compliance. There had been an attempt to test compliance back in the 1940s. There was a landmark Supreme Court decision, Morgan versus Virginia, in 1946. Irene Morgan was a woman from Baltimore who was arrested for refusing to go to the back of the bus, sort of Rosa Parks style, in 1944. She represented herself at first, then the NAACP took her case, Thurgood Marshall and others took it all the way to the Supreme Court, and they won. And it seemed like segregation on interstate buses and trains had been declared illegal. But the attorneys general and other officials in the South simply ignored the decision. And they made all kinds of excuses why they couldn't enforce it. They said that the segregation was actually being maintained by company rules of railroad corporations and bus corporations, that it really wasn't state law, that it was mandating Jim Crow, all those sorts of things. This led to the first Freedom Ride. They didn't call it a Freedom Ride. It was known as the Journey of Reconciliation, where 16 volunteers who belonged to the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the Congress of Racial Equality decided to do a Freedom Ride to test compliance with the Morgan decision. But they only did it in the Upper South. They knew if they went to the Deep South, to Alabama and Mississippi, it might mean major violence, maybe even certain death for them. So they spent 2 weeks in April of 1947 traveling on trains and buses in Virginia and Tennessee and Kentucky and North Carolina. Several of them were arrested. Bayard Rustin, one of the organizers, and three others ended up on a chain gang for 22 days in North Carolina. But they didn't get a lot of attention. The press carried it, but it really didn't effect a revolution. But it set a model for civil rights, nonviolent direct action.
So what happened in 1961 that led to the formation of the Freedom Rides?
The election of John Kennedy gave new hope, I think, to civil rights activists. Even though he didn't have a particularly strong record as a senator, had not shown a great interest in civil rights, he talked about a new frontier. He occasionally used the rhetoric of freedom that suggested that he might be open to this, not just in foreign affairs, but in rearranging the nature of domestic life in the United States. And of course, there were the onset of the sit-ins, beginning in Greensboro, North Carolina, in February of 1960, the so-called youth movement, which is a harbinger, of course, of things to come later in the 1960s. So there was a sense that maybe nonviolent direct action on a mass scale was becoming possible, even in the Deep South.
When the Freedom Riders formed in 1961, did they have the same goal as the group in 1947 did, to try to force the government to enforce an already existent law that said that interstate bus travel could no longer be segregated?
There were two landmark Supreme Court decisions, Morgan versus Virginia in 1946, which seemed to outlaw segregation on interstate buses and by argument trains. But then in 1960, in December of 1960, there was a second decision, the Boynton versus Virginia decision, which appeared to outlaw segregation in public accommodations related to interstate travel, so that you could get a cup of coffee at a lunch counter, at a train station, or in a bus station if you were involved in interstate transportation. It used the Interstate Commerce Clause as the legal kind of lever to strike down state and local laws which mandated segregated facilities in restrooms, in restaurants, in lunch counters, and so forth. So there were two decisions. And it was really the Boynton decision in December of 1960, which was the immediate reason for thinking that another Freedom Ride or a set of Freedom Rides was in order.
Raymond Arsenault speaking with Terry Gross. Arsenault is the author of the book Freedom Riders, 1961 and the Struggle for Racial Justice. He'll be back in the second half of the show. Here's a 1963 recording of the Core Freedom Singers singing Get Your Rights, Jack, their own version of the Ray Charles hit. In this version, the chorus urges Jack not to be a Tom and to join the movement. Jack decides to get on board, then demands his rights from Mississippi Governor Ross Barnett. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.